This is Mouth Media Network. Amplify and connect.
Hi, I'm Alicia Yoon. I'm the CEO and founder of Peach and Lily. What I love about beauty is it really allows people to slow down and take some time in the midst of their busy schedules for some good self-care.
Imagine identifying a trend and driving it to a tipping point that created a new category in an already crowded American beauty market. With a mission to transform people's skin, Alicia Yoon created Peach and Lily, based around the advanced science and techniques of Korean beauty. Coming up, you'll hear how Alicia was able to grow Peach and Lily into a thriving business without taking any institutional funding, and how her grandfather's entrepreneurial spirit sparked her passion and the bigger vision for her company.
From New York City, you're listening to Beauty is Your Business, covering the intersection of innovation and business in the beauty industry.
Welcome to another episode of Beauty is Your Business. This is Karen Moon, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kelly Kovac of Beauty Matter.
Hello.
So, Alicia, so excited to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
So, tell us more about the evolution of Peach and Lily, because it's you guys were one of the earliest innovators in K-beauty before everyone was talking about it. And tell us about the unique challenges and opportunities, because there's a lot of innovation. I'm sure you had to do a lot of education in the market to get people excited about crazy ingredients like egg cream and snail. Walk us through that.
Yeah, so I started Peach and Lily back in 2012, where you were really able to find just a couple Korean beauty brands in the national retailers. And otherwise, you were really looking on eBay and maybe getting products that were even used. You might have found things deep in, you know, Koreatown. And even there, the assortment wasn't that much. And so in 2012, when I started Peach and Lily, you know, it was really built on this mission to help people transform their skin. And I started with Korean beauty because there are so many interesting innovations there that weren't available here. And so you're just giving people more tools in their skincare toolbox to help transform their skin. And I struggled with severe eczema growing up, and I never thought I would hear, oh, you have good skin. But when I became an esthetician, But when I went to esthetician school back 20 years ago in Korea, I really learned how to transform my skin. So it was really built on that passion. So when I started Peach and Lily, I didn't have a grand plan on what will the business model look like, you know, how will it evolve. It was just driven by this kind of north light saying, let's help people transform their skin. And what does that look like? That guided everything that we did. So in the beginning, we started off as a third-party retailer for Korean and actually Japanese beauty brands as well. And, you know, that curation process was at the heart of what we did. We really thoroughly vetted everything so that it was really only like 5 out of 100 brands we looked at, which made the cut onto our site after focus group testing everything. And from day one, we also had estheticians be the only one who could answer skincare questions. And it was all complimentary. So we started our journey that way. And what I quickly realized is that when it comes to skincare, people still make their first purchase, the vast majority of people, offline. And then they might replenish online. And it became very clear to me that if we really wanted to get these great tools in a skincare tool chest out there, it really needed to be available in offline channels as well. So with that, we ended up working with different national retailers. So we were distributing these products to these retail channels. But it wasn't just, you know, behind the scenes retailing. We were really helping to inform what that section looked like, what the messaging would be at the retailer. So we brought Korean beauty for the first time to QVC with the snail mucin. We helped launch the Sephora's first ever Korean beauty section. Urban Outfitters was actually the first one to take a big bet on Korean beauty. We also had a year-long pop-up at Bergdorf. We opened up the biggest Korean activation nationwide in CVS. We had this section in Target that was sort of curated by Peach and Lily at Target. They actually had my picture in their aisle. That was definitely something that I had to get used to. But it was really such a joy and privilege to be able to inform, you know, which innovations would really help people. But ultimately, as we started to see all the emails we were getting from our estheticians and consumers and the conversations, we had these deep qualitative insights as to what people were really looking for. And we saw that there was these amazing Korean beauty brands and technologies, but then we also have our community here in the US. And we saw that there was a space where we can create our own brands that kind of marry the two really specifically. And so we ended up launching our own household brand, Peach Slices, that's distributed on our website, as well as CVS and Target. And then Peach and Lily, our eponymous prestige line that's on our website and nationwide at Ulta. So that's kind of been the evolution, but at the core, the mission to help people transform their skin remains the same.
Got it. It's so interesting to see the evolution. There's so many pieces of B2B, B2C. It's kind of touched all elements, kind of like the expert in this space.
Well, also, I think, you know, it was interesting to watch Korean beauty sort of pop up almost like it seemed like out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And evolve into this sort of crazy trend that got really fast traction. To almost now it feels like it's not so much a trend, but just a category that's here to stay.
Yes.
But from your perspective, do you also feel like the type of brands and sort of what K-beauty means has evolved as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny that you mentioned that it kind of just popped up out of nowhere. And that book, Tipping Point, has never seemed more true for me, because when we first launched Peach and Lily in 2012, it took a good 18 months of just being this relentless, almost like evangelist of Korean beauty to see it take off. And it was just, you know, meeting, I would say I met maybe like 40 different editors and knocked on, you know, dozens of, you know, retail channel doors. And it really was this tipping point where the first really meaningful press happened with W Magazine. I ended up going to a meeting. Katie Becker was the editor there at the time. And now, you know, of course, she's the beauty and health director at Elle Magazine. And, you know, it was my bag of products from Korea. And I wanted her to just talk about the products. And she was like, actually, I'm interested in the whole story of Korean beauty and what Peach and Lily is doing to curate. And so she actually came with me to Korea for a week.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it was this, like, we called it soul beauty tripping. And it was this 2-page spread in W Magazine about our little company and Korean beauty. And it was also on WMag.com. And the story was really, really well received. And after that, I ended up getting a lot of emails back from editors and so forth. And all of a sudden, it went from that to, you know, I was just talking about Korean beauty to editors who wanted to write about Korean beauty, like, nonstop. And so it took this... It really was this tipping point. And I think outside of editorial, really also with content creators at the time, Instagram wasn't really big at the time. It was really just these microbloggers that we were talking to. And ultimately, there was that tipping point where then we started working with much bigger influencers. And it was really interesting to be a part of that, you know, tipping point, and to help, like, move it from obscurity into really being a big part of the beauty and really being kind of this mainstay part of beauty. And I think the way that I've seen Korean beauty evolve is, in the beginning, it's this new category. So it was just sort of like, Korean beauty, what does this mean? And there were different kind of entry points into it, whether it's like a new ingredient story like snail mucin, let's talk about that. Or, you know, the multi-layered routine, let's talk about that. And it was really these sort of, or new product types like sheet masks and essences and rubber masks, let's talk about those things. And it was sort of like this hodgepodge of different entry points, but still very high level. And then I started to see the conversation shift as people became more familiar with Korean beauty to more techniques. So, okay, like these are all the great products and ingredients, but how do you actually apply it? Like, are there these tips and hacks that we should know about? And then I saw that evolve into less kind of high level topical like Korean beauty, but really singling out brands and really focusing on, well, this specific Korean brand is really clean and eco-friendly. This specific one is such a cool derm-based brand. And I think that's a sign that the category is maturing in people's minds from like an education standpoint, but also that it's not a trend.
You know, it's so interesting just hearing you talk about Tipping Points and the ascension of your business and K-Beauty actually kind of very much aligns with the ascension of digital and influencers. So it's this kind of like unique, you know, element. It's funny, when we started my old business, like we actually chose case studies of different types of understanding how trends happen and, you know, predictive factors. And actually K-Beauty was one of those ones. Because if you look at like BB cream specifically as the first evolution, because what's interesting is if you think about K-Beauty, the way we're talking about it, it's like with the masses, but it's always been a like an insider secret, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the beauty industry would go out east to see what innovations are happening there. And if you think about the early pool of beauty junkies before beauty, you know, it really existed, yeah. It's your early customers that they were like looking for these products and stuff. Right. So how much, because you've seen this kind of rise, but also with influencers, how much do you think that helped kind of propel the business or kind of growing with that versus, you know, looking backwards now and trying to find your way in?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that, number one, it would have been really, really expensive and maybe even not possible to really grow K-Beauty as a space unless you're this big incumbent trying to do that without the digital marketing platforms and social media networks. It just made it really, really efficient and effective in getting, you know, in some senses, a complex story out there because there's so many different facets of this like whole country's beauty heritage having to be shared. And so I think for sure the two are related. And I do think that, you know, it's hard to tell if, you know, the fact that the Korean beauty space and the kind of content creation space grew together, if that would have been easier, or if the content creation kind of if the universe of content creators is more established, would it have been even more efficient mm-hmm. in getting the story out there? That I'm not sure. But I do think that 100% without the social media networks, this would have been a much less efficient process.
Well, it's interesting because like so much of K-Beauty is wrapped around, obviously there's all elements, but skincare. And if you think back now, skincare is definitely having the moment over the last couple of years. But in the beginning, when all the social media was about color, everyone was trying to figure out, well, how can you do skincare differently? And, you know, if I think about the tenets of what makes something work on social, it's like transformation, experiential or experimental, and like the interesting ingredients have the perfect education story element for social. Like, talk to me, how did you get people over the hump around some of these, like the mass consumer around some of these different types of ingredient stories or things that seemingly seem like weird or different? You know what I mean? Like, how did you
yes.
get people to react?
It was a very, very nuanced thing. So because we have products that are for the mass channel, then we have like prestige products, and we weren't just bringing in a certain type of Korean beauty innovation. We were bringing everything from, you know, snail cream, which is maybe a little bit easier to understand because it's really the ingredient story, to an ampoule that has microspicules in it that act as like sort of feels like microneedles on your face. And what are the benefits of that? Like, it was just so many different types of innovations. And so we actually had to be extremely data driven. And so every single time we would have an innovation launch, what we would do is we would quickly A/B test five different ways that we're going to, we would very quickly test five different ways that we're going to measure if this innovation will take off. And once the answer is yes, then we actually look to how this innovation will take off. So for example, some innovations only take off. It can be the most articulate, well-explained blog post, but it takes like one demo video for that to really take off. Or some could be like visually very demonstrative and it could be on video, but you actually really need to read specifically how this works for people to get comfortable. So because it's not as straightforward, we actually internally had to develop a very, very structured set of data sets to look at to start to draw correlations, because we also are organically funded. We never took outside institutional funding. So we had to figure out how to do this in a really smart way. And our mantra has always been, every month you have to get smarter about innovation. And at the hub of our business, in some senses, we're this innovation insights hub. And we need to be able to harness the right insights, not just on which innovations, but how to make those resonate. So it was a very, very nuanced endeavor. But I do think that because out of necessity, we had to do that, that's actually become one of our core competencies. And that's actually also been really helpful in driving our household brands as well.
It's amazing. I think one of the things, and just talking about sort of K-beauty and the rise of social, skincare was definitely sort of slow to pick up because products weren't developed for social. They were developed sort of in a traditional way based on efficacy, not thinking about sort of the visual component. And I think sort of the early days of K-beauty, between the packaging and kind of some of the shock value ingredients, they were unintentionally perfectly staged for social. Yeah. For social. But one of the interesting things I found out, I was in Korea about 6 months ago, and the majority of brands that I spoke to were like, don't call me a K-beauty brand. And it's almost had this backlash of, you know, we're not just cute, we're not just shock value, we're a real brand. So it's kind of, it's interesting sort of how it's come full circle. Have you seen the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's interesting to me is if you can imagine American beauty brands, when we're here in the States, these are just beauty brands and they'll identify as I'm clean, I'm, you know, high performance, you know, what have you. And then let's say that Korea imports American beauty brands and starts to call it a beauty. And
well, that would be confused with Australian beauty. Yeah. Now.
Exactly. So USA beauty. Yeah. And let's say that they kind of prescribe on it. They're a little bit more, I guess, less nuanced understanding of what that means. And it doesn't capture the whole picture. So I definitely do realize that with Korean brands in Korea, for them, this is just their identity. But K-beauty has specific connotations that they're like, well, okay, but we're not any of those things, or we are those things, but so much more. So I definitely do see that a lot of Korean beauty brands try to establish, like, outside of any kind of macro category, we are a very distinct and specifically special brand. And they take a lot of pride in that. So for sure, when I have conversations with them, because we really are so selective about which brands we curate, and as you can imagine, the really, really good brands are so selective back about who they work with and how you're going to present the brand. So there's actually lots of conversations around, how are you going to communicate our brand story? What do you think our brand story is? Like, you know, is this going to be, you know, just a big flash, or are you really talking about the longevity of our science because you're going to see results? So I have a lot of conversations around how to present them.
Well, it's interesting, as kind of someone being the curator of the brands, especially when you have these authentic brands that were, I mean, I've got to think that the packaging and everything was in Korean, you really had an essential, you know, role in communicating even how to use the products, I've got to imagine. Like, that must have been like a really interesting hook that a traditional retailer,
yeah,
you know, doesn't have? I mean, what was that like?
Yeah, so some brands are much more, I would say, developed in how they think about the global beauty industry and how their brand fits into that. There are some brands, the formula is incredible and people are seeing amazing results, but it's literally not going to resonate here in the US because people just don't think about, you know, a product that way. And so we actually have to work with them in terms of even like repackaging the component to one of the brands. I even came up with their name because the Korean, like they had this like name that was not going to translate.
Well, it's so interesting. That's so important for any international, like, yeah. You know, you just have to know the market or it could really backfire. Right.
Right. And so we really hold hands with the brands and we have long-term partnerships. And it really kind of runs the range. Some brands just have a lot more complexity that they've already baked into thinking about like markets all around the world. And so, yeah, it is definitely something that I don't think is super typical for retailers to be doing. But yeah, we gladly do it. And we do think that that is the value that we can bring to the table, not just for these brands, but for our consumers, because, you know, it's almost like there's this really cool tool in your toolbox, but it doesn't come with an instruction manual.
Right.
And, you know, what is this? And we try to like simplify that and make that resonate.
So fascinating. There's so many facets of the business. Cool. So we want to break into snack time. So this is a partner show where we get to learn a little bit more about what you're interested in. And so what snacks did you come to share with us today?
Korean seaweed.
Ooh.
I love Korean seaweed.
Korean seaweed. We actually have these snacks in our office. And I just thought this was very representative of our Peach and Lily collection because it's very healthy, very, very clean, non-toxic ingredients, and it's Korean. And then...
Is it also good for your skin or like the nutrients?
They say that potentially, yes.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It's so good for your health in general. And then for me, I have jasmine green tea here and... I think this is representative of me because I have a lot of energy like this today.
Well, thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome.
Coming up, you'll hear why Alicia turned down VCs and decided to build her business without external funding.
Hi, I'm John Mattson. I'm one of the hosts of Travel Is Your Business. And if you're interested in what's going on behind the scenes within the travel industry, you have to check out this show. We cover everything from the aviation industry to hospitality, hotels and accommodations, even in-destination and touristic experiences. If you work within the travel industry, this is an important resource for you. You'll hear from not only executives and leaders within the industry, but also new innovations and technologies that are coming to market right now. And if you're not in the travel industry, you're going to gain insights that help you connect with a traveler and their experience to advance your career. So come along for the ride. You can listen and subscribe to Travel Is Your Business wherever the best podcasts are found.
I love that you were an esthetician before.
Yeah.
That's so authentic. I was like, oh, maybe you should do that later. But no, 20 years ago, this is like so you.
I mean,
you're made to do this.
I was like just walking around with rashes bleeding all the time.
Oh my God.
And it was just something I was like, I guess that's my skin. Because my mom tried everything and she was such a hero. Like doctors, like acupuncturist, bleach baths, everything. And sometimes it would work and then it would come back and it was kind of this big guessing game. And I ended up just saying, like, I want to go to school and after school and just like learn the science of like, what does your skin look like inside? And maybe I'll understand. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really helpful. And all of a sudden, I could take a more like scientific approach to this has this ingredient, therefore, and like, how do I manage this? And if I don't sleep, then I need to use this. And it started to work. Mm-hmm. So then I became obsessed. So starting college, I was doing like facials nights and weekends.
Oh, no way.
Like a lot of my college friends are like, I'm so not surprised that you, like, they were like banking. And then when I started Peach and Lid, they're like, do you remember the facial you used to do?
That's amazing. That's perfect.
I was like, yes, I do remember.
I can't think of, I love it when you meet founders who are just so authentic to their core of, you know, because I mean, it's just so obvious. You're like, you were like made to do this business.
Thanks.
So on that note, you know, in school, you're an esthetician. That's a really interesting story and has such authenticity. But also, you know, you've worked in banking, you've worked in consulting at all the top firms. What was your decision? You mentioned earlier that you were self-funded or had no institutional capital. How did you think about that decision when there's so much hype about startups raising a ton of money from all the best VCs and about what's your paper valuation? How do you kind of think about those choices you've made in growing your business the way you did organically?
Yeah, so it was a very intentional choice. So after business school, so went to Harvard Business School in 2008 when the financial crisis was happening. So right when we got into school, there was a pretty big focus from the school on supporting entrepreneurship. And it really made me think about what is my passion and what, you know, is there something entrepreneurial that I could do right now? And I've always in the back of my mind wanted to do something entrepreneurial. My grandfather's a serial entrepreneur, and I always just thought like his life seems amazing. And so, you know, just kind of tinkered around with various ideas during business school. In fact, I started a company that's very similar to Peach and Lee, but in fashion, bringing fashion, Korean fashion over. Also love fashion, but it wasn't scalable. Like sizing was an issue, like content labeling was an issue. So I really loved consulting, which I did before going to business school. So went to BCG after business school because I just was like, I still didn't have that moment where I was like, this is a company I would start. And meanwhile, while I am a consultant, I'm still doing facials.
Wait,
weekends.
How come I never got a facial? Where can I set up an appointment?
And so, you know, I'm thinking like one day I realized this is what I'm so passionate about. And people are, you know, talking about these products that I like bring back from Korea and how it's really changing their skin. And, you know, I still didn't really think about doing Peach and Lily. But one day when I was consulting for a global beauty company here in the States, one of the cosmetic chemists kind of just stopped me and it was just small talk. Are you Korean? Yes, I am. You know, your country has some of the most innovative products science-wise. And that was like an immediate light bulb for me because you can see the ingredient list and I can tell that the ingredients are for sure different. But the science, it's hard to know that unless you're in a lab. So just understanding the results, like the stability of a specific natural ingredient is, you know, really able to be held in this formula with integrity, even without these other ingredients, or the absorbability of this formula is 10x higher than this one. Like these are things that I just had anecdotal, you know, conversations with, you know, the people I was giving facials to, but I'm also like, maybe they love the products because I just gave them a great facial. You know?
I'm sure that was part of it.
When they said insiders, I really meant it's all the product development teams at all the big companies that would go to Korea, before it became a thing.
Exactly. And so right when I heard, oh my God, it's not just, you know, something that people are arbitrarily thinking, wow, the science is so advanced. And that just completely blew me away thinking, wait, it's 2012. It's a globalized world. And some of the most advanced skincare products that, you know, your skin is an organ, like these scientifically backed innovations, it's just like not even available in one of the biggest global like beauty markets. And so I went to HR that day and I was like, I have to start this company because I'm passionate about skincare and I can't even believe that it's not here. And BCG did make it easy for me where they were like, okay, this sounds great. You know, have a shot at it, open door policy back. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go do it.
They and really are supportive of people. It's incredible.
I loved working at BCG. They were a great, great firm to work for. And so when I then started Peach and Lily, you know, I had the benefit of having so many friends from HBS who had started companies. And I asked a lot of my friends, like, okay, so what do I do? And they actually had introduced me to various VCs, and it was almost like sort of like a startup foundation playbook. And I took the meetings with the various VCs, even received some term sheets preliminarily. And I went home and I started to feel this intuition. First of all, it's very flattering that, you know, here's like this money that I could potentially have. But at that point, I told myself, well, let's think about this realistically. I had a PowerPoint presentation and I don't have a single customer. I don't have a website. I don't have a single brand secured. It's a vision. And while the vision is all potential, I actually think in reality, this business is not worth a single dollar yet. And in my mind, you know, it just kind of felt to me, first of all, I think that will make me path dependent on continuing to have to raise money. If I raise money today without knowing how I'm going to spend it to make that return back for investors. And second of all, I was thinking about the business itself. And because we're not building a tech platform where all these people need to first join the network to monetize, and it really is, in some senses, a meat and potatoes type of business. You're making and buying products and selling them. And I thought that needs to be pretty sustainable out the door. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Like, if I have to pay so much in marketing to acquire customers and convince them that this is something that's great for them to try, it only gets harder later because, you know, the earliest consumers are the most efficient to reach. And it kind of made me realize, you know, I'm not sure that scale buys you profitability later. You can't just like grow at whatever cost. And so I just kind of told myself, you know what, let's just do this with my savings and we'll just kind of take it from there. And it was a very specific, intentional decision. And hindsight is 2020. I'm really glad that we went down this path of not taking on any institutional funding because it cultivated this DNA of being data-driven, really, really resourceful, thinking outside the box. We didn't hire anyone with a beauty background. It wasn't even a choice. It just ended up being that way until 1 year ago. But, you know, at the moment, for sure, there were a lot of times I kind of questioned my decision when I had like $7 left to my name and I was like pizza or Subway or, you know, like taking the Subway or walking and then I can have pizza or, you know, like I was working out of my apartment and my landlord's like, you have to leave if you don't make your rent this month because it's kind of been a while. So there were definitely scary moments where I was like, what am I doing? But despite those challenging times, I think deep down inside, intuitively, I still believed that that was the right choice. And it wasn't that the business was growing rapidly, but there's just like your cash flow issue. And,
right.
You know, I was like, if anything, this is actually more of a maybe get a line of credit type of business. And so, yeah, the first couple years, it was pretty rough. And then, you know, within the first few years of the business, we became cash flow positive, and now it's going into year eight.
Thank you.
Amazing. Yeah, now it's going into year eight of the business. And looking back, I really believe that that choice was such a watershed decision for our company because it actually started this domino effect of building this entire culture around thinking about things differently, doing things that are very data-driven, not just experimenting wildly on the marketing side, having a very structured way to A/B test everything. And I like, it's really interesting. Like when I walk around the office today, you know, it's very, very, even when someone new joins the business, you know, immediately they're kind of having conversations about,
well, let's think about why did this work? Why didn't this work? Is that really the right insight? Did that work really because the colors are colorful? Maybe it's because our hero product's there. And it's like this critical thinking that is such an ingrained part of the culture. So yeah, that's how we went about doing it.
When the business is doing really well, can you give us a sense of scale, just like number of employees and things like that?
Yeah, so last year in 2018, we did $30 million in sales, and we're still really lean. We're 20 people.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations. I think a lot of times people look at success as how much you've raised and what we see and what's on paper. I think the dirty secret is, you know, if you're selling the business and depending on what valuation you get, a lot of times founders, early employees, and early stage investors might get zero. Right? And so I think there's an education that's kind of happening in the market. For every amazing Dollar Shave Club story, there's others that are overfunded. And like, we kind of have to start thinking about unit economics and, you know, what does the acquirer landscape like? Or you may not even have to do that because you own your own destiny. So I think that's like a huge, you know, it's a different way of thinking, but it's obviously, I think more and more people are going to come around to that.
Do you have any advice to entrepreneurs who haven't taken money? Because cash flow is a huge thing that people don't think about. And sort of the more successful you get, the more difficult I think managing the growth becomes.
Yes.
Were there vehicles that you used to sort of help you get through that?
So we actually haven't put in a line of credit yet, but that's something that, you know, I think a lot of companies can more easily put in place because you also have inventory that you can collateralize. And there's, you know, we've explored it. We just never ended up, you know, it always kind of got deprioritized, but we had looked into the process and it was relatively straightforward. So that could be a really, really great vehicle. I would also say that there's managing growth and looking at growth rates that you want to hit, but there's also just like every single day, like having a really good sense and a pulse of how the cash flow is working in the business. Because I think if you're not looking at that every day and the cycle of how that working capital is going, it's easy to have like blind spots. I also think that your suppliers could be your best bankers in a sense, and, you know, really trying to negotiate with them great terms, because that just helps so much. And that's like the most efficient way to, you know, in a sense, raise capital, or that like slight bridge. And I think that ultimately, it's also really important to, especially if you're doing direct to consumer, to look at your cohorts and understand like when that payoff will be. So when you're looking at customer acquisition, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. But taking a conservative view is really helpful. So even when you attribute specific things on digital, you might want to do a 1-day click attribution versus like over the course of 3 weeks. So just having a very conservative view on what the true cost is to acquire the consumer, and when you're going to have that payoff, and thinking about what the true lifetime value is, and really analyzing the different cohorts that come from different specific areas that you're acquiring them, you know, which are sort of the best consumers, right? And so I think being really nitty gritty in the weeds with your business and managing all of those aspects is super, super, super important, because then you're never surprised. And you can see it from even like 5 months away when you're going to have to like turn something off or do something different. And so I think that was really, really important for us to do. And what's kind of ironic now is, you know, after 8 years, after having been profitable for a while now, we've created 60 somewhat SKUs or get, like self-funded. You know, it's a very different position now to be thinking about, do we potentially raise money? Because now we have very specific methods developed, and we know if we raise that, this is exactly how we would use it. And this is the return, give or take some beta, pretty much this is what we're going to get out of it. And are we comfortable with that? Versus, I think it's a really expensive way to take on money when you're more like, I'm going to take it on to kind of figure it out. Because maybe like 50% of it goes to something that kind of yielded like not any return. And it was more a loss. And so, and I do think the structured A/B testing, I know I keep saying that a lot, but it has helped us so much because we're literally able to see like in a very small way and really looking at the digital marketing metrics like every day and even changing things mid-flight in an ad campaign so that you're not just like, oh, it's a test, but it's if it's not working, it's not working, you can stop it. And that's like the beauty of digital marketing also. But those structured A/B tests really drive deep, deep insights. And it's pretty surprising to see the learnings from that when you apply that, you know, how huge the return could be. But you just have to run a lot of those tests and have that, like, you know, really data insights kind of organization and mindset. And it's worked really well for us.
Well, I also think that sort of raising money now 8 years later, after having sort of built your business, understanding what works, it also changes the dynamic with the investors. Because, right. You know, I think I see a lot of startups that get pre-seed and seed money, and it is just an idea, and they don't know what's going to work, but the investors are still want a return on their money. So, you know, I think as a founder get sidetracked by always thinking about, do I need to raise more money, keeping your investors happy, you know, trying to take their insights and apply them, even if you may or may not agree with them. So you're sort of doing all of this management of having raised the capital or raising more capital, and you don't really have time to focus on the business.
100%. Like, we still haven't raised money, but as we contemplate if we should, one of the things that we always say is, it's almost like, I always use the analogy, it's almost like getting married. I kind of feel like, you know, single life is great. If and only if the right partner comes along, is that a great choice versus it's just something that I just have to do because if not, you know, I'm not in charge of my own destiny and I can't self-sustain the business, then I think you start to make some really dangerous compromises for your business where all of a sudden you might have a partner in the mix who isn't aligned with you in terms of vision, values, goals, all of those things. And the conversation dynamic is definitely very different. And I don't think money is just money. I think it comes with the partner you're getting the money from. And so, yeah, I think it is hard, but I think that, you know, with the right kind of business model, the right kind of tenacity. I mean, it was really hard. And one of the phrases I loved during this roller coaster ride was, I mean, there were days that I was like, oh my God, my life is really bad right now.
And like, it's what so hard. Am I doing? So hard. Entrepreneurship is so hard.
I think whether you raise money or not, being an entrepreneur is hard.
It's hard.
But I think because there's been sort of, I mean, you know, I was part of the first wave of indie brands back pre-internet. So to see, you know, this like indie brand explosion and with it sort of a bit fueled by money behind these indie brands, if you want to call them that, you know, there's this idea that, you know, a valuation or how much money you raised is some signifier of success. And I'm sort of like, well, what happened to launching a brand and running a really nice business and that being successful? And I think that maybe we're seeing, I mean, you're definitely doing it that way. And I think, you know, I think success comes in lots of different sizes, not necessarily with $1 billion
right, and you can valuation on it. So on that, what is the bigger vision for Peach and Lily?
So I think we are still really, really guided by that single-minded mission of helping people transform their skin. And so, you know, we have more innovations happening for the Peach and Lily brand and for the Peach Slices brand. And, you know, we are still actually 100% in the U.S. We do ship internationally from our e-commerce site, but we actually don't have international distribution yet. And we have a lot of inquiries about that from consumers. So that's definitely something that we're contemplating. And that's the other thing that I think we have this DNA in our company where you want to do one thing really, really well. And even though it sounds like we do a lot of different things like distribution, et cetera, like when you boil down to it, the heart of our business is still around creating and curating the best of the best, understanding those insights and marketing using that method. And so, you know, when we think about international, you know, we don't want to just like be everywhere and just have, you know, like, okay, now we have this channel and this channel and this channel. Like, let's make sure that in the US market where we're based, we're steeped into it. We're doing everything as best as we can. And at the right time, we'll go international. And I think, you know, we're definitely now starting to have conversations about that. So that's definitely one thing. And then we're also really focused on content. We have always been, but more and more because when it comes to skincare, it's pretty interesting to see that people are still very overwhelmed and confused by how do I get rid of my acne? Or, you know, especially now with so much information, people are like emailing our estheticians, but I read this website and they said this, and then this website said this ingredient is okay, and then this website said to like use this only after this ingredient. I'm so confused. And so we're really trying to create more content that simplifies those things but backed by science. And then if it's, you know, things that are unknown or controversial, you know, we still just cite those sources and explain. So we just try to empower people with accurate information.
Super interesting. Thanks so much for sharing.
Yeah.
Up next, we'll hit the pan with Alicia and get a little more personal with her.
Here comes Makeup in Los Angeles, the only and unique B2B makeup event at your doorstep. The next edition, February 11th and 12th in Los Angeles at the LA Convention Center. Makeup in Los Angeles is a unique place where you can find from alpha to omega every piece of a makeup and skincare product and make your own line, advised and guided by the savoir-faire of the most qualified experts in the beauty industry. Whatever your project is, there you can find the best contact. You can ask for an invitation at the show's website, makeup-in-losangeles.com.
And now it's hitting the pan.
So at this point in the episode, we're going to hit the pan. And what we're going to do is we're going to ask you personal questions to figure out who goes first. We're going to take a spin at the salon chair and see where it lands. And it lands on Kelly.
So I think more and more people are sort of going to Korea. So what would be your sort of biggest kind of non-beauty tip that if you're going to Seoul, like what do you need to experience?
Ooh, so definitely the food, so much good food everywhere. The shopping for fashion, there's fast fashion in Korea. You can go from like concept to shelf super fast. So you see like lots of different cool designs for a very affordable price. This is a little beauty related, but I love the Korean bathhouses. It is definitely an experience, and they have like these different rooms where there's like charcoal, ice, clay, salt, the whole nine yards. And then if you're really up for it, you can go completely naked and these, you know, folks will just like scrub you down. I asked them to just go a little light on me because I have eczema, but you come out like feeling like you're just born. It's pretty awesome.
So, and it lands on me. So, you know what's interesting, also being Korean-American myself, the Korea as a cultural phenomenon has changed so much across so many industries. I mean, you look at everyone's talking about Parasite right now, which is, you know, independent film that did really well at Cannes, to K-pop to Korean beauty. Like, what is it and why is that country in so many regions from China to the US and Europe having a moment? It's like super interesting because it definitely wasn't like that when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Like, do you see a pattern or like, you know, what do you think it's all about?
I don't know, like, what is causing Korea to develop so much content, mm-hmm. both like in entertainment and also like in pop culture that resonates so much. But I do think that one thing I notice a lot when I go to Korea is it is a very entrepreneurial country. And I think that part of that might be how competitive it is in Korea. There's just more limited resources. Even to get into like the top university, it's like the equivalent of there's like too many people who are getting like perfect SAT scores and like 4.0 GPA. So like how there's too many people who are doing that and then too little spots. And so it ends up being very, very competitive. And so people are then, you know, being entrepreneurial to find their path. And I think that's become a big part of the culture. And I think that probably leads to a lot of creativity. And I think it's like, there's creativity with like a commercial eye to it too. So as they're thinking in entrepreneurial ways, they're like being creative, but also kind of marrying this to like, is this going to resonate? And it's not just, it's art with an audience for sure.
Cool. Thank you so much for sharing. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners?
Yeah, I would say going back to how challenging it can be for entrepreneurs, but I think just in general, you know, there's lots of challenges in our careers. And the best piece of advice I've gotten was don't quit on a bad day. So I that has served me really well. And then I would say for anyone struggling with their skin, you don't have to have good skin genes. I have really bad skin genes, but with the right information and the right products, you can have good skin. Yeah, I would say that's pretty much it.
Cool. And what's the best way for listeners to get in touch?
So you can definitely DM us at Peach and Lily. And then I'm at AliciaYoon212 on Instagram.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing all these like skincare tips and entrepreneurial hacks. I mean, it's really incredible. We really enjoyed having you.
Aw, thank you so much for having me.
And Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, it was fun.
This was so much fun doing together.
Yeah, it was.
And this is Karen Moon. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Beauty is Your Business. Look forward to seeing you guys on the next show. Hugs and kisses.
This has been Beauty is Your Business, produced by Mouth Media Network. Copyright 2020. Keep in touch on Instagram and Facebook at Mouth Media Network. And find prior episodes at beautyisyourbusiness.com and wherever the best podcasts are found. Your brand message can be on this show. Email us to find out more at podcast@mouthmedianetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
This is Mouth Media Network. Amplify and connect.